Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
From the land of Grandview University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report, the Crop Monitoring with Satellite Special Edition. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll explore how a couple of companies are using satellites to predict yields across the planet. We'll talk with the CEO of Descartes Labs out of Los Alamos, New Mexico, and the co-founder of TELUS Labs from Boston, Massachusetts. And it all happens right here on this edition of the Closing Market Report. Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our term of the day is hedge as it relates to agricultural commodity price hedging. A typical hedger might be a commercial farmer, so the market value of wheat, for instance, and other crops fluctuates constantly as supply and demand for them vary, with occasional large moves in either direction. Based on current prices and forecast levels at harvest time, the farmer might decide that planting wheat, for instance, is a good idea one season, but the forecast prices are only that, forecast. Once the farmer plants wheat, he's committed to it for the entire season. If the actual price of wheat greatly rises between planting and harvest, the farmer stands to make a lot of unexpected money. But if the actual price drops by harvest time, he could be ruined. If at planting time the farmer sells a number of wheat futures contracts equivalent to his anticipated crop size, he effectively locks in the price of wheat at that time. The contract is an agreement to deliver a certain number of bushels of wheat to a specified place on a certain date in the future for a certain fixed price. The farmer has hedged his exposure to wheat prices. He no longer cares whether the current price rises or falls because he is guaranteed a price by the contract. He no longer needs to worry about being ruined by a low wheat price at harvest time, but he also gives up the chance at making extra money from a high wheat price at harvest time. However, in the case of a farmer, it must be noted that the hedge introduces another kind of risk. If the farmer has contracted to sell all his expected crop but then has a bad year, for instance, a year with lower than expected yields, such that his farm is not able to produce the committed quantity, he may have to purchase replacement crop at a disadvantageous price to fulfill his futures contract. And that's our trading term for the day, hedge, as it relates to agricultural commodities.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalem. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Tuesday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. You know, there are a whole bunch of folks that are trying to use satellite imagery to predict the size of crops around the planet. One of them is Descartes Lab out of Los Alamos, New Mexico. We're now joined by the CEO and co-founder of the lab, Mark Johnson. Thanks, Mark, for being with us. Can you tell me a little bit about Descartes?
Sure. Descartes Labs is a Los Alamos, New Mexico-based startup. The original scientists on the team were all members of Los Alamos National Laboratory, where, of course, that's where the Manhattan Project was. And our goal is to advance the science of forecasting by looking at really large data sets and trying to predict things based on those data sets. We started off looking at a huge amount of satellite data and weather data. And with that, we've made global commodity crop predictions, starting off in the U.S. with corn. And one of the cool things about satellite imagery is that you can go look in the past and see what you would have said. So we've created a model that not just tells you what's going on today, but what we would have said in 2008 or 2007. And that model itself has pretty good accuracy. So we're at every point in the growing season, we're more frequent. We have a weekly release on the website. We're more granular, so we look all the way down to the county level since it's a bottoms-up model. And we're more accurate every point in the growing season. So if you look at this back test, on average, we're more accurate than the USDA predictions during the entire growing season.
So right now, you're predicting that the size of the corn crop in the United States will average 171.1 bushels to the acre. Do you have a total production figure, too, that you will be releasing at some point?
We're focusing at least to the external model on the yield. We have a model for paying customers that's even more frequent than the website. So we actually release a model every 2 days, and that includes acreage and production in that also.
And do you do more than just the United States? So, for instance, can you look back and tell us what you might have been predicting for Brazil or Argentina in the past growing season?
Yeah, I mean, already we're starting to look beyond corn and beyond the U.S. So we're testing out a soy model right now. As you know, things are happening in Brazil and Argentina right now. We're going to be looking south right after we do the United States. There's a lot of challenges down there. We have a lot of imagery and weather data down there, but as you know, the numbers coming out of Brazil and Argentina are not nearly as accurate as the ones forecasted by the USDA and the U.S. So, still working through some of those issues, but looks very promising. Applying the techniques that we learned in the U.S. And applying those globally.
Do you think that over time you'll be able to get a prediction, for instance, for the whole of the year earlier in the season? So knowing today what your prediction is as it was released is one thing, but having an idea of the size of the crop, for instance, on August the 1st and being accurate, or, for instance, August the 15th or the 20th or someplace much earlier would be a far more valuable product to have. Is that something you can see being able to develop?
Absolutely. I mean, save being completely clairvoyant, obviously there's going to be a number of unforeseen events that happen during the growing season. That being said, we also released a model in 2015. As we were working on the 2016 model, we ran a lot of candidate models. So we looked over 1,000 different models in the 2016 release. And one of the considerable improvements of the 2016 corn model over the 2015 corn model was our ability to accurately predict earlier in the season. So our numbers in the early season, thanks to a lot of work largely on weather modeling, really helped us to get those early season predictions better. We saw a lot of great gains in this model, and we expect that to continue. Again, You're never going to know everything that's going to happen unless you had a weather forecast that could go months in advance. But, you know, we're pretty confident that we can get highly accurate early in the season.
In the early development of your models, what was the pitfall that tripped you up the most?
You know, I think there's two things I would say. One is that the team is largely comprised of physicists with a few mathematicians and computer scientists thrown in there. So we looked at this with very, very fresh eyes. And one of the things we had to do was sift through all the scientific literature because people have been trying to predict yields from satellite imagery for many years. To sift through that scientific literature is a real challenge because there's a lot of false leads in there, things that are not necessarily predictive of yield at the national level. So kind of separating the scientific literature of what really worked and what didn't was a huge challenge early on. I think the thing that we've done better than anybody else is amass a huge amount of data and build a platform on which you can start to test some of those assumptions. So test some of that science to see what variables matter and what variables don't. It took a considerable amount of work, for example, to clean up the data. So things that you don't think about with satellite imagery, it's very messy. There's clouds over 50% of the United States at any given time. And trying to correct for the atmosphere, to try to correct for clouds, as that is kind of messy data that will affect your model, was really the biggest challenge for us. So we are sitting on 3 petabytes of satellite imagery. And to put that into context, that's 3,000 terabytes, that's 3 million gigabytes. I mean, this is, you know, if you were taking a picture on your phone, you know, every second for the next something like, you know, several dozen years, you might come up with that much imagery. We looked at something like 4 quadrillion pixels. And this all sounds like it's very technical, but the reason you do that is that in order to get extreme levels of accuracy, in order to get down to the county level and eventually the field level to really understand yield, you just need massive amounts of data to A, build a really good model, and then B, consistently throughout the season, update your predictions.
Can I get field level modeling from you?
We do not. We have not released that right now, but we've definitely been doing work at the field level also. You know, our expertise and our goal is really to look at global commodity crop production. So really understanding at the country level what we can do or what's being produced. But our ultimate aim is to make sure that that model is robust such that it's a true bottoms-up model that at the lowest level of granularity, that is the field, you have enough accuracy, and that builds up into a larger model. That's the ultimate vision of where we'd like to go. But you know what makes us a bit unique here is our global focus and looking at countries, especially those countries where they're much less understood. In some sense, we picked the U.S. first because the data is so good out there, and you can verify your numbers. But I think the real opportunity in terms of what we can do with our models is look to those places like China, like Brazil and Argentina, like the Black Sea region, where the numbers just aren't as solid as they are here.
And finally, what kind of cost on the plans do you have, and do you expect to leave some of the information available for free on the website?
Yeah, we continue. I think it's really important for us to share this information. You know, our cadence is so regular that we felt like it was important to get this in the hands of farmers and traders. You know, pricing, give us a call and we can chat with you. But yeah, we will continue to provide this via the website, via our newsletter, and via our mobile apps to anybody who wants to see those numbers updated on a weekly basis.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. We appreciate you taking the time with us today, Mark.
I really appreciate it, too. Thanks for having me.
Mark Johnson is the CEO and co-founder of Descartes Labs. They're out of Los Alamos, New Mexico. You can find them online at DescartesLabs.com. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, reminding you to visit our website. The address there is WILLAG.org. There you'll find most of our daily agricultural programming in its entirety. Commodity Week, our weekly look at the marketplace, as well as posted there. Before it ever airs on any of our radio stations, you'll find news and information from the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences and University of Illinois Extension, too. Along the right-hand side, depending on how you've got it set up, or if you happen to be looking at this on a tablet or your phone, it may be down at the bottom, you'll find a link to our calendar of events. The most important thing there now is March the 7th. The All Day Ag Outlook is coming up at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Put it on your schedule today. More information in the coming weeks. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This week we've been talking about satellite imagery and big data and how it can be used to predict corn yield. Soybean yields a bit, wheat yield too. One of the people that's doing that is from TELUS Lab. His name is David Potter. He's a co-founder. This is an organization out of Boston, Massachusetts. Thanks for joining us today, David. Can you tell me how you got started?
Absolutely, Todd. Thanks for the opportunity. We are a part of the Mass Challenge Accelerator in Boston. And so the TELUS Labs startup venture really began a couple of years ago. My co-founder, Professor Mark Friedel from Boston University, helped hatch this idea around bringing commercially relevant signal out of the public archives from NASA, the European Space Agency, and other remote sensing platforms. We're just convinced that there's a lot of useful information for farmers, growers, agribusiness, investors when it comes to commodities. And we're laser focused on trying to get that stuff out to market.
And so what do you do actually?
So we have built a platform in a cloud environment, Amazon Web Services, that essentially harvests, if you will, each day millions of acres of crop health information from satellites. That information is stored in a database at TELUS Labs, and combined with weather information and infield information, other geospatial data, we use machine learning to train our computer systems to forecast the end of year yield for corn, and then as of Monday this week, soy as well.
How accurate are you over time? I take it you can probably go back and do these satellite runs and get an idea over a series of years what your algorithms might look like.
Yes, Todd. Well, obviously you've got to be cautious on the back testing front, but certainly we've done that kind of work for upwards of 15 years looking back. And what we're real excited about is that in about 70% of the growing days, we are more accurate on end-of-year forecasts than the USDA forecast for that day. So if you treat the 12th of the month forecasts that come out from USDA as gospel, and you hold them constant in between forecasts, about 70% of the time, that TELUS Lab signal is going to be of higher quality for end of year.
Is it okay to say that you get to the end of the year signal or end of the year yield faster than USDA actually comes up with their final end of the year number? More accurately, that is?
I think that's fair. And that's, that's key to the enterprise that we're building here. It's that the confidence bounds are tighter and that we're able to actually put estimates out earlier in the year, so prior to the big August 12th date. We're real excited to have some reliable signal that starts to settle down early August, sometimes even better depending on the crop type and depending on the year.
So I'm pretty interested because you're a small crew by comparison to almost everybody else. Some collect peta data type size files. Others have been around for a long time. Landworth is one that producers will be familiar with and are part of a much bigger organization. How do you do it just with a couple of three or four or five guys?
Well, Todd, it's an exciting moment right now for big data type companies. And I did this at Boston Consulting Group for 7 years, bringing in big data insights to the Fortune 500. And what I noticed just in the last 2 to 3 years is the technology has really democratized what's possible. So some guys in a garage are able to do some pretty amazing things now. I'd say there are three reasons that we're able to produce these kind of results. And we think about it kind of like a three-legged stool, Todd. We think about, building quality signal for customers that really matter, whether it's in commodities or forestry or water resources or energy. You really need to have a deep understanding of machine learning and stats, and you need to have a scalable computer architecture that allows you to do that for compute and storage at a reasonable cost. The good news is the compute and storage has really become accessible. As a startup in Mass Challenge, we have in-kind support that lets us do everything we'd want to do from a compute perspective. The second leg of the stool, we think, is really understanding the data. And I'll say we spend maybe 80% of our time, Todd, worrying about the quality of the satellite data we bring in, which sensors, curating that data, worrying about the weather data, the infield data, and that sort of data prep, which is not very sexy stuff, but it seems to matter a whole lot. It's sort of garbage in, garbage out when it comes to these models. We focus a lot. My co-founder, Mark, was a member of the science team that built and operate these instruments that we use. And I'd say that the third leg of the stool, and it's one that we're humble about being based in Boston, Massachusetts, is understanding the domain, Todd. You really have to know what it is you're modeling against. And, you know, my co-founder, Mark, he's a deep understanding of meteorology and vegetation health. He's built some of the first global maps of vegetation. But neither Mark nor I are agronomists, and we work closely with agronomist advisors, and we're kind of humbly learning fast in this growing season. So our sense is if you have all three of those legs of the stool, domain, compute, and a real solid sense of the data, that's the keys to success.
So where do you go? What do you target? Because this is a big area, and dropping out a yield number for the nation is one thing. Maybe working in by county is one thing. But there are areas I would think you would want to try to look at to be helpful with agribusiness or farmers. What kinds of things do you think you can do that will really be helpful?
Well, we're learning a lot on that front. So I should say that the Kernel Beta, which any of your listeners are welcome to join if you come to our website, we have now more than 500 folks from all over the world that receive a daily or weekly signal from us. And they come from all over the value chain. Like you said, right now, they're only receiving national and some county scale maps, some state level charts. But underneath the hood at Telus Labs, we have information that's at county and even better resolution. And what we're really excited about is working with customers that run ethanol plants and milling operations who want tailored yield information to the fields and the regions that they care about. That's all possible because of the flexibility of our stack. We're even in some conversations with customers now around taking their training information. So if that customer is a very, very large grower or has access to very, very large grower output information, outcome information, our modeling framework is flexible enough that we can train on different types of data. I'd say the other, the biggest thing that has us excited right now, Todd, is international. So we have the entire planet spinning inside our Telus Labs systems, and we're real excited to putting some relevant signal out there in the beta program this winter for Argentina and Brazil and some of the other international targets that you'd expect.
Okay, before I let you go, we probably ought to talk really quickly about the beta program. It's called Kernel. It's from Telus Lab. For those who you are looking it up right now, it's Telus Labs, T-E-L-L-U-S Labs. I think that's kind of funny, but teluslabs.com, and you can find them. So if they sign up for this beta called Kernel, what do they get?
Great. And I should say it's K-E-R-N-E-L for Kernel. And what they'll get, they can choose how frequently to receive an email report from us, and either daily, monthly, or weekly. And in that report, they'll have as frequently as on a daily basis at 9 a.m. in their inbox Eastern time, a yield forecast, the implied production for both corn and, as of last week, Monday, soy. There's also some good helpful statistics around how things break at the state level and some visuals around the changing story at the county level.
Thank you so much, David.
Todd, thank you. Great speaking with you.
David Poter is co-founder of Telus Labs. If you'd like to sign up for the Kernel Beta program, you can do that online at teluslabs.com.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to improving the quality of life for Illinois farmers by offering financial products and services geared specifically to the farm community and developing partnership-based relationships with its agricultural customers, helping farm families succeed for 100 years.
It's National Sangria Day. It's also St. Dominic of Silos Day, patron of shepherds. On this day in agricultural history in 1790, the first successful cotton spinning machine built using American resources began in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Samuel Slater was the first in the U.S. to reliably duplicate cotton spinning machines. Slater had immigrated secretly from England in 1789 with details of Richard Arkwright's machines memorized while an apprentice in a mill. In 1868, Harvey Samuel Firestone was born. An American industrialist, he started the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company in 1900. In 1906, he teamed up with Henry Ford to provide tires for the Model T. By the 1930s, nearly a quarter of all tires used in the U.S. came from Firestone. His innovations included non-skid tire treads, low-pressure balloon tires, and farm tractor tires. In 1879, Thomas Edison privately demonstrated his incandescent light at Menlo Park, New Jersey. Edison found that cotton filaments could operate for 40 hours inside a glass bulb vacuum. And in 1928, Harry Ramsden opened what would become eventually one of the most famous fish and chips restaurants in the world. The business began in a wooden hut, which still stands today alongside the main restaurant, which seats 250 people. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
In the 1840s, there were about 250 varieties of corn. They originated in Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky. As farmers in these states began their movement north and westward into Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, they brought those crosses with them. 40 years later, in the 1880s, these producers had adapted the 250 varieties to the local conditions in the states across the Midwest. It resulted in 1,000 locally adapted open-pollinated varieties of corn. In 1888, Iowa, for the first time ever, raised more corn than any other state in the Union. The extra 750 varieties of open-pollinated corn, says retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer, were more drought-tolerant and shorter-seasoned than the original 250.
Out of those 1,000 varieties, I don't know the exact number, but there were probably 20 or 30 varieties that were grown much more than the others. One thing that contributed to that was the corn shows.
One of the most popular varieties was called Limming. It was developed about 40 or 50 miles northeast of Cincinnati, Ohio, in Wilmington, and had won a corn show in Paris, France. It was the first widely adapted variety of yellow corn. Half of all the yellow corn grown in the U.S. was at one time Limming corn. It actually represented just one quarter of the total U.S. corn crop, because 50% of the corn grown in the mid-1800s was white dent corn, not yellow dent corn. Well, the next big variety was to become the foundation of almost all of today's hybrid corn. It was called Reed's Yellow Dent. Troyer says Robert Reed developed the variety by accident when he moved from Russellville, Ohio to Delavan, Illinois. In that first year, he planted and saved back seed from a variety called Gordon Hopkins corn. It had been planted late in the season. The following spring, he planted the Gordon Hopkins corn again.
He didn't run a germination test, and he got a field of corn where the stand was too good to tear up, but it wasn't as good as it should be. So he went in and he hand-planted what they called a common early yellow flint that was grown in the area. And because the early corn was planted later, they crossed. And then over a period of at least 40 years, Robert Reed and then later James Reed selected Reed's Yellow Dent.
It became very popular after winning the corn show at the Chicago Columbian Exposition. Troyer says because of the win, farmers oftentimes called Reed's Yellow Dent World's Fair corn. A Perry Holden, head of the agronomy department at the University of Illinois, evangelized Reed's Yellow Dent, and he convinced the Funk brothers of Bloomington, Illinois to start producing and selling Reed's Yellow Dent. Holden later took a position at Iowa State University and took 600 bushels of reed yellow dent with him. Troyer says some Iowa seedsmen were not very happy about the introduction of an Illinois corn in their state.
It soon replaced a lot of the varieties that were formerly in Iowa.
Reed yellow dent and livestock feeding trial studies from the University of Wisconsin and Purdue are the major reasons U.S. corn farmers abandoned white corn. The university studies proved pigs grew faster when they ate yellow corn. It was because yellow corn provided a good source of vitamin A, and white corn did not. This one attribute, vitamin A, eliminated the majority of the genetic material farmers and corn breeders would work with to develop hybrid corn in the 1920s and 30s. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.